One was Mercy. He was dead before he hit the floor. Who is he? Special Agent Terrence McGraw. Counterintelligence unit out of Chicago on special assignment for me. You ever hear of the group? No. They're a right-wing extremist cell. I'm not your usual anti-government fringe type. They've got deep pockets and influence. McGraw was getting close to revealing their leadership when he was taken off. The only member we've been able to get a visual on is this guy. Goes by the name of Radetzky. McGraw had him pegged as the group spotter in charge of recruitment, making for the best, mostly freelancers. Combination of ex-CIA and DOD operatives and hitmen.
So what do they want?
Same as any terrorist group. Power. To what end, we don't know. What we do know is, before McGraw was killed, he uncovered a plot to assassinate Senator Joseph Kasem.
That's the guy running for president.
The one who will be president, if you believe the polls.
Why Kasem?
McGraw couldn't provide any more details.
So what's your next move?
Nothing. I'm calling off the investigation.
Come again?
That's right. As of today, the FBI is no longer investigating the group.
Okay, I'll get it.
You got a major conspiracy beef here,
not to mention a dead agent, and what, you want to back off?
Officially, yes. Unofficially. There's a reason why McGraw's cover was blown. He was betrayed by someone in the bureau.
What, like a mole?
I could be wrong. I hope I am. But if I'm not, there's no one I can trust anymore. Except you. I trust you because I knew your father.
I trust you because I knew your father? That sounds like a... Sounds like it. You got to base a major investigation on whether somebody knew somebody's father. Well, that doesn't sound too sharp to me. But anyhow, this is Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in Warsaw, Indiana, north central Indiana. A lot of you people don't know that the first Communist International or Marxist International was held in Indianapolis. That was before the revolution. And, of course, it was a big Klan state. And it was, during the Civil War, it was half Southern sympathizers, copperheads. Even the governor of the state was on the side of the South. this is where our friend, where Joseph Paul Franklin shot Vernon Jordan, Clinton's buddy, and several others there. So-called left-wing buddies right over here in Fort Wayne. And there's all kinds of stuff happened in this state. All kinds of stuff. Look it up. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the radio show. And I appreciate that. And we like to get them in here at least by the 20th of the month. I prefer by the 10th, but 20th will do. Incidentally, I had been keeping track of donations with my email record here, but I don't think that's quite secure. I'm going to be taking care of it on paper from now on. So, and just for the halibut, you might want to slip me a email. A lot of you guys do when you've sent your dues in or when you've sent using PayPal. Just send me a little note when you send it in. That way I make sure I get it down on pencil and paper rather than putting it in a file. Of course, I shred all the mail that comes in here after I've read it. And keep track of the donation you gave. I shred it. So I think you'll appreciate that. Well, let's get back to A Pessimist's Guide to History. I love this book. 1415 A.D., The Trial and Execution of John Huss. Despite misgivings, the Bohemian religious reformer John Huss decided to appear before the Council of Constance to defend himself against the accusations of heresy. Oh, my. He traveled there of his own free will with the guarantees of free passage from the Holy Roman Emperor Wencelius. But once he arrived, the Pope and the Cardinals refused to honor the Emperor's guarantee. They made Huss a prisoner, and many months passed before he was given a hearing. Isn't that just like power people? You never could trust them. John Huss appeared before the council three times over the next months, finally being sentenced on June 6th to burn at the stake for heresy. Now, that was your Jesus-loving Christians. You know, they don't teach that in the Sunday schools around, do they? Finally being, on July 6th, his prison clothing was removed and he was dressed in priestly garments in order that they might be stripped from him as the charges of heresy were read aloud before the council. Next, his accusers placed the sacred church vessels in his hands, again so they could be taken from him as a gesture of his sins. He's sinning. His head was shaved and a tall cap placed upon him. It read, Harisiacher. I don't know, I can't pronounce that. Later that day, when his executioners had bound him to the stake and were about to light the fire, they noticed that he was facing east, deciding that he should not have the honor of facing the direction of sunrise. He was unfastened, turned, and bound again. Now the fire was lit. The flames soon licked at his feet and then engulfed his body in a miserable, scorching death. That so, his persecutors thought, ended the heresy of John Huss. Huss had been influenced by the English religious reformer John Wycliffe. You've probably heard of the Wycliffe Bible. And brought these teachings, which anticipated the Protestant Reformation, to Bohemia in modern Czechoslovakia. Huss saw the corruption at every level of religious life and wanted to expose it. He spoke openly of the greed and ambition of monks, cardinals, and even the Pope, describing their covetousness, their luxury, and their sloth. Not surprisingly, religious leaders soon turned against him and began to call his preachings heretical. When Huss became rector of the University of Prague, his teachings were heard by the thousands. That helped to bring the schismatic Pope John the 23rd into an open campaign against him. The Pope excommunicated Huss from the church and declared that no one should offer him protection. Only by appearing before the Council of Constance was Huss to be allowed to defend himself and achieve his freedom once again. And so Huss was forced to travel to the council and appear before his accusers, where he was treacherously imprisoned. During the first two hearings, his accusers repeatedly urged Huss to recant his statement. I'm sorry, boss. Repeatedly, Huss refused to submit to the council, insisting that no teaching of his had been contrary to God's holy word. He never did recant, nor did the problem of John Huss end with his cruel execution. Instead, Huss's teachings mingled with a nascent movement toward Bohemian nationalism that in 1619 erupted into a bloody Hussite wars, which lasted until 1634. Never tangle with the hierarchy, he says here. Oh, those Christians, they're a jolly bunch. Okay, now in 1417 A.D., another massacre took place of the Armagnacs. The Armagnacs and the Burgundians, two factions of the French noblemen, had been fighting for control of the French throne since 1411, when in 1417 a popular uprising in Paris resulted in the imprisonment of all the Armagnacs in the city. The mob was not satisfied with mere incarceration, however, and later broke into the prison to slaughter the noblemen. More brotherly love. Yeah. I just can't take all this Christian love, man. It's just overwhelming me. I gotta stop. And just remember, that's what'll happen. That could happen here again, just like it did in Europe in the old days, if these Christ insanity fundamentalists really get the power behind them. Don't kid yourself, they'll do it again. This game that the Christian and Jews play is something else, because in that old Bible, it says right there that when Jesus comes back, and he's definitely coming back, that if any of these Jews haven't bent their knee to the Jesus, they're going to be burnt to death in the lake of fire, man. So I think the Jews are pretty sure that Jesus isn't coming back, or that he never existed. So I guess the last laugh is on the fundamental Christians, really. But they feel now that if they don't drum up another world war, an atomic war, Jesus won't come back. He'll be mad at him and won't come back. So they got to have a third world war. And then, boy, then things may start happening, if there's anybody left on this fucking old world. Well, let's get back to the White Knights of Mississippi. It's been a while since we were following Claude Bowers around and the boys. This is from the book written by Jack Nelson, who was a very well-known reporter with the Los Angeles Times, as far as I can remember. Title of the book is Terror in the Night, and it's probably one of the most accurate books about that period of time and the White Knights of Mississippi. And he was surprisingly fair. So anyhow, let's get back into that. This next paragraph I'm going to read has to do with the sheriff, whose name was Gunn, was lecturing his deputies to stay away from the Mexican girls. Quote, "He's just out fooling around with those damn chili dippers," Gunn would say. Quote, "You better watch out for those chili dippers," he lectured his men. "They love that uniform and they'll stay after you. So don't let them lead you astray. Now don't go messing around on your wife." That was a big problem on all sides. The cops and the Klan. There was a lot of that fornication going on, and that caused the Klan a lot of problems. One thing I want to remind you about is that most unconventional warfare or guerrilla organizations, or not, always start out at the bottom. And that's why almost all of them fail. And the Klan was like that. It's easy enough to go out and pick up a couple of dumb afros along the road and tie them up and throw them in the dam and all kill them and all that. But in the long run, what did that gain? Didn't gain a damn thing. The crooked politicians in Mississippi kept being crooked. They just changed their tune. They had been mainly racist because it paid off. And after the federal government clamped down, they were long gone and flipped sides. And then they were integrationists and loved black people, hired black people, fired white people. So rarely does anything ever change drastically. I mean, as far as white separatism is concerned, it usually... race is used against us, not for us. And that's a big problem. And you'll see that all the way through books like I'm reading here. Instead of straightening out the top, they fart around at the bottom all the time. Now, you can't always, or maybe not too many times, change things at the top. But I love the idea of politicians being fearful in their beds at night, or fearful when they drive down the road in their big old cars and things like that. If you look at Mexico and the cartels, that gives you an example, and South America and so forth. It's pretty extreme, but it works. People are afraid to go to their office, afraid to run for office, afraid to do anything because of terrorism. Well, no, that's being totally honest, that's unconventional warfare. And to waste your life playing silly little games is something you should never do. And we've had a whole bunch of these right-wingers play silly little games. Almost none of them were very serious. The Order had plans if they'd have been able to keep their units small and not try to go around the country and recruit a bunch of people. They had some good ideas. They had their list and so forth. Even had leaders of the right wing on that list, including David Duke. I bet he thinks about that once in a while. No wonder he doesn't talk about Bob Matthews. So anyhow, whenever I'm going through something like this, just understand this is trying to go from the bottom up. And there's a lot of shortcuts. Best to try. If you're going to try something, try it from the top down. Okay, baby. And you don't need a whole bunch of people to do it. Should read that book, The Making of an Assassin, about James Earl Ray, how he went about tracking his quarry, his prey. Very, very interesting. And very simple. Very simplistic. All by himself. Yeah. All by himself. So let's get on with the book. Well, anyhow, most of these boys are following VNN and Stormfront and all that kind of crap. And I guess I'll have to learn the hard way. Every once in a while, one of them's toted off to federal camp that didn't have to go if they'd taken a little advice or had a few good tactics or strategies or something. They keep on listening to the doctor and Mr. Black and Mr. VNN. And then they come up with guys like Craig Cobb. I liked him in the beginning. I thought he was a very smart guy and was going to do something, but he's playing the same old right-wing game. It's interesting. He's all tied into VNN, and he's tied into, of course, VNN's the same outfit that thought Glenn Miller was a wonderful guy, and even though he was a raving alcoholic and had been married to a Vietnamese gal or Southeast Asian woman, had half-breed kids, that was all okay. And then going out and shooting a couple of Christians walking down the street thinking they were Jews. I mean, you know, that VNN's a strange outfit. They seem to back some of the crazy people. Yeah, that right-wing bunch is a crazy bunch, because there's other lots up there in Leith, North Dakota. I offered to one right-wing gal, it's a little fruity, but offered to buy it from her. And to a right-winger, the minute you say you want to buy something, automatically they think there's some big secret, there's a fortune involved, and you're going to make a lot of money, so I better not sell it to you. So I forget it. I don't care. If I get time, I'll read that deal about Craig Cobb again, out on trying to do the same thing. It's called Muddy the Water Politics. Always play a strategy that falls into your enemy's camp. Always help your enemy by doing shit that don't make sense and backfires on you. Well, Sheriff Gunn's moral concern extended beyond the police department and included what people saw at the movies. He shut down the Royal Theater when it attempted to show an R-rated film called Bloody Mama, based on the gangster exploits of Ma Barker and three of her four sons in the 20s and 30s. Well, that was no R-rated. Well, it might have been R-rated at the time. It's pretty tame today. I've seen the movie. The Marquis let the Meridianites know. Chief Roy Gunn says Meridian can't see Bloody Mary. Bloody Mama. Well, that figures. Typical cop with his head in his ass. Thought he had a little power, and he did. He didn't have the power, just the rest of the people were too chicken shit. Say, I'll go to any goddamn movie I want to, and you can bring your gun down here if you want to try to stop me. Gunn acknowledged that he had not seen the film, but he had been told it included one nude scene and two nudes from the waist up and was vulgar and indecent. These Southern boys are the biggest hypocrites in the world. I'm sorry, they are. They're running around on their wives and hanging out at titty bars all the time and screwing their neighbors' wives and everything else and going to church on Sunday. And then they get all upset because a movie comes to town with a nude scene. I don't think I'd last too long even now down there. A court overturned the ban and the movie played to packed houses. Well, he made him more money, that's one thing. But Gunn was proud of his stand and kept a clipping of the Meridian Star's article on the controversy in his scrapbook. Because he was a good Christian man. Quote, the law to him was black and white, and he had no philosophy to him whatsoever, said Elsie Logan, a Meridian stockbroker who served with Sheriff Gunn on the board of stewards of the Hawkins Memorial Methodist Church. Gunn was chairman of the board. Quote, he never had any question about what he was doing. He was adamant about the rightness of his actions. Yeah, there's a hell of a lot of people like that around. He was absolutely sure that every word of the Bible was true. Even Jonah swallowed by the whale and Jesus walking on the water and Lazarus coming up out of the grave. He believed every bit of it. He never had any of the doubts about that that some of the others of us had. Tell me about it. I doubted it way back when I was a little kid. Took me a long time to get away from it, though. Gunn's certainty reinforced his legendary temper. Well, like most cops. Many recall the time that the Atlas Roofing Company was embroiled in a labor dispute and a striker fired a shot that shattered a truck driver's windshield. The chief ordered so many officers into the three available patrol cars that they were virtually hanging out the windows like Barney Fife as they raced to the scene. Gunn rode shotgun in the lead car. Boy, I got to get those strikers. Yeah, by God. Got to get those strikers because the fathers of the town got all the money and they own the company. When the cars screeched to a halt at the roofing company, Gunn jumped out with a megaphone. He climbed on the hood of his second patrol car and held out his arm to look at his watch and bellowed, "All right. I'll give you just 5 minutes to get your asses out of here. You can leave two pickets, but they can't sit down. If you're not out of here in 5 minutes, your asses have had it, working man." The crowd instantly dispersed, leaving two pickets standing alone holding signs. If they had not left, he would have shot them. White man. I have no question about that, said John Proctor, the resident, famous but incompetent agent in charge of the Meridian office, said. On another occasion, when tensions flared in Meridian's black neighborhood, and there were rumors that the Meridian police might be target of violence, Sheriff Gunn showed up at a noisy demonstration, quote, I'll do what I can to see that there's no violence, and I'll sit on a curb and negotiate with a nigger prostitute, unquote, he told the crowd. But the first son of a bitch that throws a brick at one of my police officers is dead, There was loud murmuring among the demonstrators, but the crowd dispersed. You got to understand that most of the time, cops are for cops. And they'll shoot down a white man. Of course, you know that. I know that. Almost as soon as they would a nigger. In fact, maybe quicker. Gunn's disregard for due process was reflected throughout the department. When Meridian police lacked evidence to make arrests, they would simply book suspects on the charge of DNS, dangerous and suspicious. That put most of us in jail, and most of them for as much as 72 hours, while they tried to dream up some fake charge. During the early part of Sheriff Gunn's tenure as a top police official, the department was riddled with Klan members and went in for brutality. Quote, a den of hatred, Elsie Logan called it. The detective's interrogation room was a torture chamber, like Guantanamo. The lie detector, a 2-foot-long black leather strap with a metal spring in it, was used to questioning blacks. And an electric cattle prod and a contraption rigged up with wires and 2 batteries were used to shock recalcitrant suspects. Well, I'm sure that at that time I would have had nothing to do with law and order. That brutality is something that really doesn't work. And I would not have faulted the niggers if they'd have dropped that son of a bitch in his spot, because he was worse than any problem they had between the whites and the blacks. Those kind of people. Marie Knowles, the Detective Bureau secretary, never got used to the sound of clubs smashing against skulls and prisoners screaming in pain. Quote, they would pop them with anything that was handy, she said, and sometimes just backhanded them. When she had taken the job 3 years earlier, she was 24 years old and had 6 children to help support, 3 from her first marriage and 3 from her second husband's marriage. At first, she had found the rawness of the life hard to take. The officer's conduct had shocked her nearly as much as the crimes. Rough-natured men with little formal education or professional training. They lived hand-to-mouth on low wages and met violence with violence. Knowles had a close-up view of the rotten side of life, as she put it. She knew who was going with who, and when they were doing it, and what night of the week they were doing it. And when the detectives were using the burrhead sticks or nigger knockers on some poor black, she would have to leave the room. Just to take a coffee break till they were done beating up somebody. Some FBI agents, famous but incompetent, made it their business in that period to avoid the Detective Bureau when they thought suspects were being interrogated, because they didn't have the guts to watch. The agents reasoned that since they had to work with the local police, they had best avoid situations that might require them to investigate the detectives. On one occasion, Everett Keeler decided to play a joke on a new FBI agent assigned to Meridian. Keller got a young black to go into the interrogation room with a policeman and act like he was being beaten, recalled John Proctor. While the policeman pounded the desk with a leather strap, the youth hollered, "Don't have mine no more. I did it, I did it." When he heard that, the young agent turned and ran out of the police station. Must have been one of those New York Jews, FBI guys. Somehow, during the rise of the civil rights, civil wrongs movement, and the resurgence of the Klan, Sheriff Gunn underwent a dramatic conversion. He began to take seriously his obligation to enforce the law even-handedly. I wonder if anybody was putting money in his pocket from the feds or the Jews. He turned against racial violence, and as much as any man in the state, he dedicated himself to ridding Mississippi of the Klan. Well, they were a challenge to his authority, of course. In doing so, he set off a virtual blood feud with the White Knights and made himself the indispensable man of the FBI and its allies in the Jew community. Y'all bet he became highly respected by that Jew community. The change seems to have begun with Jack Rucker and Frank Watts, the agents who had been sent to Meridian in 1964 as part of the new Southern FBI, man, knew that unless they could persuade Sheriff Gunn to change his own attitude and clean up the department, the Bureau stood little chance of breaking the back of the White Knights in an area that was fast becoming the main battleground. Watts remembers that he and Rucker spent hours and hours with Sheriff Gunn in an effort to change him. "You've got to change there, Sheriff." In a way, he was honest as he could be. I don't think he ever told a lie, but he was hard-nosed and uneducated like so many of the police officers in Mississippi, and it was tough convincing him that he needed to be professional and needed to make his police force more professional. The Meridian Police Force was like a lot of other local police departments. It was pathetic. Probably all full of Barney Fifes and muscle-bound guys from the farm. They didn't have any training, and if you were a big, burly guy and could stand up and breathe and knock the hell out of somebody, then they'd give you a badge and a gun. That's the way Sheriff Gunn was brought up. And a lot of police in his department, too. We had to persuade him you couldn't go around slapping handcuffs on suspects and then pulling guns on them. For instance, if the FBI agents told him they wanted to interview someone, the chief would say, quote, "Go out and get the son of a bitch, handcuff him, bring him to me," unquote. For all the patrolmen knew, the subject might have just robbed a bank. So they would go out, slap handcuffs on him, and take him to the police station, only to find out they had brought in a respectable businessman who could ill afford to leave his business and who might not even have the information the agents needed. Watts and Rucker advised Gunn that it would be much better for the officers and that they would get more in cooperation from subjects if they treated them courteously and gave them the benefit of the doubt and not cuff them just automatically. I think we lived in a different country back then. I know it was a lot different than the country around here. For all Gunn's hard-headedness, the efforts of Watts and Rucker, the FBI agents, gradually began to have an effect. Signs of change began to appear. The chief stopped talking about niggers and began talking about how he wanted people to respect the police department. Well, by this time, I'm sure he's getting some of that Jew money. Jackson Jew money. It was one morning while sitting in the church that Gunn had the experience that strengthened his determination to change. There was the Reverend William Apperson, a member of the Committee of Conscience, remembered Gunn coming to see him about the experience. I think he saw Jesus. Apperson, the pastor of the First Christian Church in Meridian, had become something close to a father confessor for Gunn. There you go. There's your Christianity. First Christian Church's approximately 500 members were an open-minded, a Protestant congregation as any in Mississippi. Open-minded, does that mean they had a hole in their head? And Apperson was no stranger to racial violence. He had been in Kentucky when the Governor Happy Chandler had called out the National Guard to quell violence over school desegregation. And in Meridian, a rock had been hurled through his window bearing a message to him, his wife, and two young daughters. "You and your family will get yours." You know, it never pays to make a threat unless you're going to do it. There's nothing worse than people like that. I had a million of them. maybe not a million of them, but a lot of them. On this occasion, Gunn had attended a Sunday evening service that Apperson had conducted. It was a warm summer night. As other members of the congregation drifted away to their homes, Apperson and Gunn stood under a streetlight on the sidewalk in front of the church. Quote, "I've reached the crossroads, and now it's do or die," Sheriff Gunn told Apperson. Quote, "I've got to do something about enforcing the law for everybody, and I've got to do something about the police department. It's too fucked up." He did not go into details. He didn't have to. He and Apperson had talked before about Sheriff Gunn's growing frustration at not being able to trust some of his own men because they were Klansmen. Lone wolves, maybe. "We both knew what he meant," Apperson recalled. "It seemed to come to him as a conversion experience. It was a real about face. He said, I can't carry water on both shoulders anymore." After he shared this with me, said Apperson, "I simply made a couple of comparisons. Well, Chief Gunn," I told him, "you are doing the right thing. Your own Wesley went through the experience of having his heart strangely warmed, and many years before that, Martin Luther confronting the princes of the Catholic tradition at the Diet of Worms, said, here I stand. God knows I can do no other." Christianity was so imbued in the South. I mean, it still is. It's retarded the whole population. Unbelievable. "That's about where I am," Gunn responded. The next day, Gunn sought out Bill Reedy. Reedy's father and Gunn were close friends, but the young lawyer had often argued with Gunn about the police department's treatment of niggers. Gunn, repeating what he had told Apperson, said, "Reedy, I don't think I had a religious experience, but something happened sitting in the church today. Yesterday, I decide that I'm the damn law in Meridian, Mississippi, and if the law doesn't apply to everybody, it doesn't apply to nobody. I think you're right. If they started killing off black folk, next they'll get all the Jews, and then they'll get the Catholics, and that means you, and you and me are friends." Soon after, Gunn assembled the police department and issued an edict. Quote, "You can be a member of the Meridian Police Force, or you can be a member of the Klan. But if you're a member of the Klan, you can't be a member of the Meridian Police Force." He required the 85 members, jeez, of the force to sign a loyalty oath, denying that they were or ever had been members of the Communist Party. Yeah, there were communists running all over the South. At least they convinced people of that. Or other subversive groups. Well, the most subversive group in the South was the state governments. And the most subversive group in Washington, D.C. is the federal government, which, according to Sheriff Gunn's decree, included the Ku Klux Klan and other hate groups. Several officers quit outright. Several took early retirement. There should have been some of them remained lone wolves and undercover. Of course, they probably all went around town or to bar and every place else bragging about KKK guys. I remember years ago, they'd pull out their membership cards and show them to everybody and everything else. There was no secrecy in the Klan. Quote, "Some of the others just lied and signed it. Well, that's good. Gunn told a local reporter, "By some estimates, more than half and perhaps as many as two-thirds of the members of the department were Klan sympathizers." Oh, my God. Sheriff Gunn decreed that there would be no more nigger talk in the department and that henceforth the law would be applied equally to all people, except some are more equal than others. To show he meant business, the chief ordered the arrest of several Klansmen on misdemeanor charges of trespassing and disturbing the peace after they were caught lighting crosses in the yards of members of the Committee of Conscience. You know, that was always a waste of time. Offenses of the police had previously winked at it. Columnist Tom Etheridge ridiculed the arrest in the Jackson Clarion Ledger and likened the cross burnings to flashing the V for victory sign during World War II. Ken Fairley, then a Clarion Ledger reporter, watched Sheriff Gunn read the column, then angrily telephoned Etheridge and one of the Hindermans who owned the paper. He was furious and told them, "I've read that crap in your goddamn paper about the arrest for burning crosses, and I want you to know that if you come down to Meridian and I can find a way to do it, I'll throw your ass in jail." At the urging of Watts and Rucker, the two forlorn FBI agents, Gunn sought to upgrade the and outdated equipment of his force in February 68. In an open letter to voters, supported a bond issue to finance improvements. He maintained that the police department was 40 years behind times in techniques and equipment. He wrote that in 35 years he had been on the force, the number of officers had increased from 17 to 85. Talk about a fiefdom. 85 cops. And deplorable jail cells, only one small cell block for female prisoners with no accommodations whatsoever and no cell at all for juveniles. They have to be placed with hardened criminals, the perverts, the robbers, and others assorted with professional crooks. There was a touching side to Gunn's efforts to follow the FBI's lead. He issued a strict dress code and required detectives to wear black shoes and broad-rimmed felt hats that had been, but no longer were, the FBI's trademark. They were ordered to wear them at all times when on duty, regardless of the season. The hulking figure of Sheriff Gunn, limping down the corridor to the bullpen, intoned, "Yeah, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil," as he was wont to do. Could strike fear into the hearts of the most hardened detectives. They knew that he caught them barehanded more than once, and they would be suspended without pay for 3 days. No small matter considering the officer's modest pay. Spotting violations of his hat decree, Gunn would order Marie Knowles to type up a succinct memo. Quote, "Detectives have been observed bareheaded," unquote. No yarmulkes. The chief of detectives would immediately take the names in order. "Everybody get your hats on. If not, put on a yarmulke." Sloppy dress and uncleanliness were likewise grounds for suspension. Once when a young rookie's patrolman who moonlighted as a shade tree mechanic fixing automobiles in his yard, showed up for work with grime under his fingernails, Sheriff Gunn told him, "I'm going to suspend you for 3 days to give you time to get that grease out from under your fingernails," unquote. Spotting an officer with his shoes scuffed up, Sheriff Gunn ridiculed him. "Look at him. His shoes don't match. He's as worthless as tits on a boar hog," unquote. To the White Knights, Sheriff Gunn's about-face was more than an outrage. It was dangerous. Sam Bauer's lieutenants did their best to punish and intimidate the chief and all who supported him. There were death threats, harassing telephone calls late at night, and more. Well, you see, that's all bullshit. You either play the game or you play the game. You don't make telephone threats or all that kind of shit. If that's your bag, you do it. Sheriff Gunn responded by organizing trusted police officers into the Black Shirt Squad. Well, I didn't know he was a fascist, which began using some of the Klan's own tactics against him. In addition to gathering information about Klan activities, the Black Shirts waged their own COINTELPRO of anti-Klan harassment, in other words, illegal activity. sometimes going so far to set off small explosions outside Klansmen's houses or shooting into their homes to intimidate them. I guess the pan calling the pot black here. The chief felt he had almost a divine mandate to stop the violence in Meridian. Sounds like Constantine. He was never a Christian, but he carried out Christian brutality. And he agonized over his inability to do so. His war with the Klan put tremendous strain on him and his family. On those nights when the Klan threats had been received, police cars were stationed in his neighborhood. Sheriff Gunn would eat supper and climb the stairs to upstairs bedroom in front of the modest frame house at the corner of B Street and 24th Avenue near downtown Meridian. There in the hot, humid darkness, he would sit for hours with a shotgun across his lap, looking out the window at the empty street and waiting for the Klan. They never came. With all the restraints, strains on his department, Gunn felt that there was not enough manpower to keep a permanent guard outside his house. And one night, when he had removed the police watch and was standing watch himself, the Klan set off a powerful stink bomb in front of his house. The wind was blowing away from the house, so it caused only a minor problem for the guns. But the foul odor permeated a hospital several blocks away and caused such discomfort that the patients had to be evacuated. You see, that's kids' gun stuff, playing games, stink bombs and stuff. That's not guerrilla warfare. That's not unconventional warfare. Gunn's daughter, Amelia, saw her father become so frustrated he would get very emotional and cry like a baby. At Hawkins Memorial Methodist Church, he broke down and wept while telling the congregation he had failed in his mission to stop terrorism. He often would cry while praying if he happened to be frustrated over not being able to solve the latest cause of racial violence. Elsie Logan recalled they were terrible times and it just killed him. He couldn't have things his way. He was determined that there would be no killings by the Klan, and he yearned to stop the violence, unless it was his. To drive his point home, Sheriff Gunn made a speech at the weekly meeting of the Meridian Kiwanis Club and startled the members by waving a shotgun around, declaring that he had been subjected to threats and that two known Klansmen had circled his home planning to attack him and his family, he said. Quote, "This is what a man is subjected to if he's got guts enough to stand up for law and order. But it will not deter me personally or my department from doing our duty, but will increase our efforts fourfold. And I pray to God that to spare my life long enough that I can be a pallbearer to these people's funerals so as to send them to hell where they belong." To a lot of applause for that. The club gave him a standing ovation. The sheep are like that, you know. Somebody talks tough, they'll get up and clap their asses off, but don't expect them to do anything else. Early in June, soon after the Meridian Synagogue was bombed, Al Binder and George Mitchell drove to Meridian to meet with Watts and Rucker. These were two more FBI agents. With the bombings in their own city still unsolved, both the Jackson Jews had begun to carry guns wherever they went. The Hinds County Sheriff's Office, agreeing with concern expressed by the Jewish community that any activists might become a Klan target, had deputized them along with Joe Harris and several other Jackson Jews so that they could legally carry firearms. Well, you can carry all the firearms you want, but you've got to have the balls to use them. And I would say probably not very many of those Jews or not very many of the non-Jews had the balls to use them. Binder was armed with a gleaming new Colt 38 with his name engraved on it, presented to him by Detective Luke Scarborough on behalf of Chief Gunn and the Meridian Police Force. although Binder did not consider the detective as necessarily a sympathizer with the Jews. They are Christ killers. Scarborough endeared himself to the lawyer by taking him out to a firing range and teaching him how to shoot the pistol. You know, I said, kept saying Gunn was the sheriff. I guess he was the chief of police. He wasn't the sheriff. Unless he held down both jobs. At their meeting in Meridian, Mitchell asked the two FBI agents, you know, I wonder if that Mitchell's related to that Mitchell that's their big race baiter, race criticizer, and that works for that paper down there, the modern paper, the same paper. He spent his whole career spreading shit on the racial cause. Money to buy information, said Watts, echoed Roy Moore of the Jackson FBI office. You'll get it, Mitchell, the Jew said. At his office, Moore had immediately decided to mount a full court press in Meridian. He had ordered additional agents to the city and dispatched a cable to the Hoover, saying that the FBI laboratory and identification facilities already had been made available to local and state authorities. Military intelligence, the Secret Service, and other relevant federal agencies were being alerted. Agents had been instructed to contact all Klan and appropriate informants immediately. What would they do without informants? The question, well, they can't do much if you're operating on your own. The questioning of known Klansmen turned up nothing fruitful. One Klansman reminded the agent that the Jews are the biggest nigger-loving people in the world, but disclaimed any knowledge of the bombing. Well, I'm afraid you're wrong about that. There's plenty of racism among the Jews. Okay, plenty of racism among the Jews. Yeah, that's not true. Plenty of racism among the Jews. If you don't think so, just ask a couple of them. Part of the Jews are big hypocrite, you know, and claim they love the Negroes and all that. They use the Negroes, just like whites use the Negroes. But they are pretty much a nigger-using, not loving, bunch. Nor did the FBI's thorough canvassing of persons living near the synagogue turn up anything. One man said he had heard a car go past on the street a few minutes before the explosion, but had not seen it. And the crime scene yielded little. No bits of wire or fragments of detonator caps that might be traced. Well, they should have sent it over to the CSI in Miami. They'd have figured it out. They were not quite up against the blank wall, however. At long last, they were zeroing in on a shadowy figure known as the Man. He and Danny Joe Hawkins had become the Bureau's prime suspect. Like I say, I shouldn't be repeating it all the time. I knew Danny Joe Hawkins for a brief time. According to FBI informants, the Man reported only to Bowers, and dealt with almost no other members of the White Knights, which he was very smart in doing. He was extremely careful. He never showed up at a Klan rally. Yeah. He guarded his identity. He was cautious about using telephones. He struck with lightning speed and then disappeared from the area. Now there is a lone wolf. A real lone wolf. The Bureau did not yet know who this mysterious figure was, but it was finally on the right track. Chapter 9. Early in the second week of June, the Anti-Defamation League, of course that's the enforcement arm of the... what the hell's the name of it? B'nai B'rith, the Masonic End. That's the Jew Masonic World Order. They don't talk about that much. You don't even hear much of the right wing ever talking about B'nai B'rith. I don't remember even Duke ever talking about the benign breath, but that's the heart of the power, the behind the scenes. The ADL is just a research outfit that sneaks around and finds stuff out about people and snitches to the cops. Typical Jew. Okay, Dean had received an urgent telephone call from Botnick and had agreed to meet him during a layover. Botnick looked greatly alarmed and more nervous than usual when he rushed up and declared, "Something almost beyond belief has happened." Well, you know, the White Knights went after Botnick. They almost got him. Chief Gunn and Mayor Key had come to see him in New Orleans on June the 2nd. Botnick told Dean and had identified Raymond and Alton Wayne Roberts as the ones responsible for the Meridian Synagogue bombing and most of the other Klan violence in their area. Botnick said Gunn and Key had asked him if the Jewish businessmen who were putting up the reward money would be willing to purchase bodies and not testimony. And according to a Dean memo, in other words, they're going to kill him. And according to Dean memo recounting his meeting with Botnick, they also asked Botnick if he would make a contact somewhere in the north, such as Chicago, to have two Klansmen liquidated. I think this is where they wanted to bring in guys from the mob. Now, they play this mob thing up real big, but mobsters put on their goddamn pants one leg at a time, too. If they're out to get you, you just get up earlier in the morning and get them. So what's the big deal? The two Klansmen were Raymond Roberts and Alton Wayne Roberts. The mayor and the chief assured Botnick that if he could make the arrangement, there would be no investigation if they killed these two guys. While Gunn was widely known as a hot-tempered zealot capable of violence, Al Green Earl Key was a gentle, friendly man and a local hero. For the mayor to be party to such a proposal would be staggering. A famed aerial stuntman during the barnstorming era of the 20s, he and his brother Fred had set a world's record for endurance flying, keeping their planes in the air nonstop over Meridian for 27 days and nights. Shit. Wonder where they pooped. A record not broken until Skylab 2 spaceflight in 73. Botnick, according to Dean's memo, told Gunn and Key he could not do what they had asked. The mayor then asked what he would suggest they do. Botnick said that he told the mayor that rather than shoot the Roberts brothers, it would be better to get them to talk. He said he told the mayor and the chief to take the two Roberts brothers out on a dark road at night and beat the hell out of them to within an inch of their lives, to which the Roberts brothers should have been armed at all times and been prepared to kill anybody who tried to fuck with them. He said that they would do this and then offered money that the Roberts brothers would talk. For all Botnick's alarm for their proposal, he told Dean he brought it up at a meeting of the Jewish businessmen, and far from rejecting it, they had indicated they didn't give a goddamn how the mess was cleared up, but only that it was, to protect us fucking Jews. Gunn was acting out of fear as well as anger. He told Botnick that he and Key had seen a Klan assassination list, and both he and Key were on it, along with the 8 Mississippi Jews. Meridian police had picked up rumors through Klan informants that the Roberts brothers were personally pressing for Gunn's assassination. Well, pressing hell, keep your mouth shut. If you're going to do it, do it. God, I'll tell you. Oh, boy. A Scarborough memo quoted 2 different confidential sources as saying Raymond Roberts contacted Sam Bowers and wants to eliminate Chief Gunn and possibly 2 FBI agents. Well, why would you contact Sam Bowers? If it needs to be done, you do it. Don't front off Sam Bowers. He didn't need to know about it. Like Gunn, Watts and Rucker were focusing their attention for more on Raymond and Alton Wayne Roberts as keys to ending the wave of violence. but they were also still trying to pin down the identity of the elusive terrorist they knew only as the Man. Their first break came when news of the hunt for the Meridian Synagogue bombers prompted a report about a Tommy Terrence who had desecrated a synagogue and had made anti-Semitic threats in Mobile. When agents followed up on the tip, they learned that Terrence had been indicted on federal charges of possessing a machine gun after his car was pulled over the previous December in Collins, Mississippi. The incident linked Terrence to Sam Bowers, who was his passenger that night. And I bet you anything I know where that those machine guns came from, because I knew that there were two brothers that were really, really great down there. That once one of my guys told me that the one brother had taken him out to his car at sort of a clan gathering and opened up the trunk and it was full of machine guns. That's probably how Terrence got the machine gun. I don't know. I'm just surmising. Like Gunn, Watts and Rucker were focusing their attention and more on Raymond and Alton brothers as the keys to the end of violence, but they were also trying to pin down that identity of the elusive terrorist known as the Man. The first break came from the news hunt for the Meridian Synagogue prompted a report. Oh, I read that. In a teletype message to the FBI, famous but incompetent headquarters, on May 30th, 3 days after the synagogue bombing, the FBI identified the Man as a fugitive from Mobile named Thomas Albert Terrence. Another FBI memo noted he should be considered armed and dangerous, and that agents were searching for ties between him and the Meridian Klansmen. The Meridian Police Department had their own network of informants, and they too were coming around to the view that Terrence was responsible for the synagogue bombing. Detective Scarborough dictated a detailed memo headed Wanted as Fugitive, which spelled Terrence's name in the same phonetics the way the FBI had its report to Hoover. Well, you remember, while they're busy down there burying Negroes in a dam, they should have been burying informants in a dam. Thomas Albert Terrence, a.k.a. Nick Anderson, Nick Allen, white male, 21, date of birth, 12/20/47. Gee, he was a young guy. Subject was arrested in Collins, Mississippi, 12/22/67, with Sam Bowers, and had in his possession a machine gun and was in a stolen car. Jeez. He went to Mobile and threatened a rabbi and also a civil rights worker. Mistake. He told an informer that he had robbed a supermarket of $4,000 and that a Klansman in Mississippi was going to hide him out. Mistake two. Subject was boasting that he knows how to use explosives. Mistake three. At this time he is driving a 54 to 56 blue and white Pontiac with Webster County license. 78. Last fall, subject went to Laurel and worked as a Masonite employee from August until April of this year. He is a big braggart and tells people he enjoys killing. Boy, I'll tell you, people talk themselves right into the slammer. On March the 26th, he was known to possess a .30-06 rifle, an automatic pistol, and a machine gun. At the time Sam Bowers was arrested, it was known that Terrence was in the area of Laurel, Mississippi, and was also known that the Roberts brothers met with Sam Bowers and expressed to him his dissatisfaction that enough is not going on. L.E. Matthews, who was supposed to take Bowers' place as Imperial Wizard of the Knights of Ku Klux Klan when he leaves for prison, came to Meridian, and when he returned he said that he had a man in Meridian that was capable of handling the job well. His name was Raymond Roberts. Roberts told Matthews that he had to go down south to get somebody to pull a job. this Matthews, I think, was connected. I think when I met with Bowers, that the lady that owned the house, I think she was the widow of Ellie Matthews. I'm not certain of that. It's been a long time. Terrence himself had been in hiding since March, out on bond on illegal machine gun charge. You can imagine today he wouldn't be getting out on a bond. Your ass would be going away big time. He had enrolled at Mobile College in January, hoping to present a better image to the authorities, but when a federal indictment being prepared in the case, he doubted he would get off this time with a wayward as a wayward youth. So in March, facing the indictment and almost certain conviction, he decided to go underground. He immediately set out on a trip to the West, visiting anti-Semitic, anti-Jew, Dr. Wesley Swift in Lancaster. Well, of course, I never met Dr. Wesley Swift. I knew his wife, his widow, but I didn't know him. But I had a lot of his tapes. Terrence would later testify he bought a rifle from Swift with plans to use it to shoot Dr. Martin Luther King. That was my ambition, to shoot Dr. King, Terrence said later. I hated Dr. King. Well, James Earl Ray did it for you, man. And Swift, he had weapons. Swift was in on this. There were weapons all over the desert. They buried them everywhere. That was on the around the time of Robert Depew's Minuteman. On March 23rd, when he returned to his home in Mobile, he found the FBI waiting. Yeah, teams of agents were sitting in two cars parked outside the house. He spotted them before they recognized him, however, and escaped. Well, you're lucky, buddy. You can't go back home like that. I knew a guy who was in our Klan that did something stupid. And he jumped bail and went back to Oklahoma and worked on a dairy farm. And he was working there for 2 years or better. He was free and clear. Then the dummy goes back to San Diego and goes to his mother's house. And Lieutenant Zerbe, one of the cops I knew, because they were in on investigating the assassination attempt on me, he was sitting outside waiting on him. He just had a figure, feeling sooner or later he'd come back home. And they got him, and then he went away for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, and I ran into him someplace. I said, "What are you doing now?" He said, "Well, I'm working for the drug task force." So for years they've been taking guys out of, they get out of federal prison, and they make ATF agents out of them, or not agents, but working with them. And that, of course, this all reminds me of hunting rabbits. You know, like I said before, I used to hunt rabbits quite a bit, put food on the table when I was a kid. You kick up a rabbit, don't go chasing a rabbit, you let it run, and the rabbit will go around in almost a perfect circle and come back to right where, near where he started. And you're there waiting on him. That's the natural explanation for this kind of stuff. Within a week, Terrence was in a safe house located in the mountains of Franklin, North Carolina, staying with friends who were followers of Swift. Swift had a lot of followers. He had a lot of followers, and they were pretty tough people, and connected with right-wing radicals in Miami. Months later, FBI agents backtracking on Terrence Trail interviewed a neighbor of the family. The neighbor said the house was used for meetings of extremists from Mississippi. They were probably just having Bible study, you know, identity Christian Bible study. Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, as well as North Carolina. He described the host family as extremely anti-black and anti-kikish. And one member has crazy enough to blow up the White House. The area behind the house was used frequently for target practice. with firearms ranging from pistols to automatic weapons. Using the North Carolina House as a base, Terrence was soon making forays into Mississippi for meetings with Bowers and new attacks on Klan targets. He saw himself as a patriot and as a closely identified himself with another notorious felon and anti-Jew on the run, Robert Depew. My friend Robert Depew, I met him on two or three occasions, head of the paramilitary Minutemen. In his notebook one night, Terrence wrote a memo that he thereafter carried with him everywhere he went. The note stipulated that it was to be made public, but Terrence never released it. "Gentlemen," the memo read, "please be advised that as of March 23, 1968, I, Thomas Albert Terrence III, was forced to go underground or be arrested and imprisoned on framed federal charges of violation of National Firearms Act and other miscellaneous charges. My decision to make this announcement was in part influenced by a single announcement by the great patriot Robert Depew of the Minutemen, in that my situation is very similar to his, and I have decided to make public this announcement. I will further state that I have always believed in military action against the common enemy. I have committed myself totally to defeating the communist Jew conspiracy which threatened our country. Any means necessary shall be used. On March 23, 1968, I was forced to go underground or face framed federal charges of possession of a submachine gun in Collins, Mississippi on 21 December 67. Please be advised that since March 28, 68, I, Thomas A. Terrence, have been underground and operating guerrilla warfare." And that's it for today. And I'll be back tomorrow, which is what? Is this Monday? Yeah, this is Monday. Wait a minute, I better look at. Where'd the clock go? Somebody stole my clock. Well, I'm sure tomorrow is Tuesday. And I'll see you then, 14-5. I'm amazed at all the people in this book that I have met or known. I didn't realize it was that many when I read it the first time, but that's the case. Yeah.
We live, we fight, and we die for each other, not for you.